This is Lizzie Boyle and Connor Boyle of Disconnected Press, and you're listening to The Geek Show.
Hi everyone, and welcome to 4Panel, The Geek Show's dedicated comics, manga and graphic novel, graphic literature podcast. My name's Rob, and joining me today, as always, is Andrew.
Hello.
So, how are you, Andrew?
I am good. I think I am safely recovered from the week we took off to take part in the secret infinite crises on Civil Wars 2s.
Oh, is that the one where we lost Mick? Sadly, he was a casualty.
He was unfortunately retconned out of continuity.
Yeah, he was a casualty of war. It was a war across podcasts.
It was. But, you know, if you subscribe to our Patreon, I will do you a special variant cover where Rob is just holding Mick in his arms. Just like Superman and Supergirl.
Sorry. The thing that worries me now, though, is, as I said before, that Mick is going to somehow return in some kind of supervillain type character. You know, the good guy gone bad.
I take issue with your use of the term good guy.
Yeah, I know. He runs for fun.
He is a monster.
I think Rob from... Rob, who's doing all the video stuff for us, the other Rob, that is, he made the comment, it's a 10-kilometer fun run. There's nothing fun about running 10 kilometers.
It is an oxymoron.
No.
And he's an oxymoron from running it.
I always found oxymoron to be a funny term when a Greek person explained to me that oxy means or acute. So oxymoron literally means acutely stupid.
I mean, to be fair, I would describe myself as a cute moron.
Anyway. This is a new look 4Panel.
Yes, it is. This is like officially episode one of what we're kind of dubbing season two.
Yeah, we had
our all new, all different, fresh start 4Panel legacy.
Yes, we had a really long season one. It lasted a couple of years. And you know what? It couldn't have happened at a better time because I have it on good authority that the Big Bang Theory is finally ending, or has ended.
Yeah, I think it's got like one more season left.
I thought they'd ended it already.
No, I see that they renewed it for a 12th season, which absolutely, like, even if you are a fan of the Big Bang Theory, that's enough of a show. I think at that point you're not allowed to complain about it ending anymore.
I mean, the news basically lied to me, which is nothing new given it's the news, but I mean, on BBC News today, it had the Big Bang Theory has ended. I'm like, yes! And now I'm, no! Why?
It's okay. Just like, one more year, I guess, and then that's it. It's gone forever.
I've been saying that about Trump as well.
One more year and he'll be gone forever. Which, you know, by the time this episode goes out, that joke is either going to be, like, hilariously predictive or just really depressing.
Yes. Oh. So anyway, on this new version of 4Panel, what have we decided, Andrew?
Basically, we've decided that we can just do a news section by saying that anyone who wants a news section, just play this clip over and over. So, DC have announced a new movie based on spin wheel of random DC characters. Marvel have relaunched all their books with new issue number ones. Comic fans have been terrible to someone on the internet. And there, that's it. That's all the comic news.
Oh no, you did forget one more bit. Marvel have also announced a new movie starring spin wheel of random, very obscure characters that no one's ever heard of.
That is true. And hey, speaking of Marvel obscure characters that no one's ever heard of.
Yep.
That in no way works as a segue into what we're doing now.
Yeah.
Which is fun discussions / basically just us fixing the comic and comic book movie industry.
I have my fix-it hat on.
Yeah, so this week, to kick things off, what we're going to be talking about is the fact that now that the Fox-Disney merger has gone through, Fantastic Four and the X-Men will probably be coming to the MCU. How's that going to work?
Well, I've been waiting to have this discussion for a long time. You know this.
I do, because I feel like we've talked about it in bits and pieces, you know, over odd shows, but this time we're going to, you know, put the gloves on and get elbow deep in this.
Yes, yes, yes. We're going to get right up to the elbows in this. So, I reckon, right, just throwing this out there, just to start us off, I reckon that the first thing they're going to do is a full reboot of X-Men.
Oh, yeah, like, that is definitely, they are going to reboot both those series instead of, like, trying to bring the Fox stuff and, like, fold it into Marvel continuity. That's definitely not going to happen.
But the problem I've got with that, though, it's not a problem. See, this is the thing. I envisioned one particular problem with doing a reboot of the X-Men as being Deadpool 2, right? Because there's that cameo in Deadpool 2.
Oh, yeah, but, you know, actually, I will say I'm hoping Deadpool will be the exception.
Well, this is the thing. I'm hoping Deadpool will stay as Deadpool. But what I think is going to happen is that they'll just say, look, it's Deadpool, you know? And they'll just say, he's just jumped universes. That's all that's happened.
Yeah, it's like, I want a Deadpool 3 or 4, or whichever one it is by the time this actually happens.
Yeah.
Where Deadpool is just completely aware of the fact that he has now jumped over to the Marvel Universe.
Yes, totally self-aware, which is what we expect from Wade Wilson.
It's what makes those movies fun.
Yeah. I do want to see Lady Deadpool, though, just to maintain that gender equality.
Also played by Ryan Reynolds.
Yes, or I'm just throwing this out there. I think that possibly Sarah Silverman might work as Lady Deadpool.
I feel like that is some kind of terrifying demonic pact you have made.
You understand exactly why, though, don't you?
Yeah, no, I can absolutely see that.
So, just throwing this out there, I reckon Sarah Silverman would be great as Lady Deadpool. I mean, she's going to be in the full costume pretty much all the time anyway, so... But of all of the female comedian that I can think of, probably the only one who has enough of a mouth on her to go toe-to-toe with Ryan Reynolds in full Deadpool mode.
That them doing, like, snark-to-snark combat would be very fun.
Yes.
But anyway, that's just a side property. What about the big guns themselves?
Ooh, who could Charles Xavier? I know that people want... Well, people would obviously want Patrick Stewart to reprise his role as Charles Xavier, but I think, you know, I'm not too sure about that. I think that it's a role that he's firmly left behind with Logan.
Yeah, well, that was, like, the point of Logan was him, as much as Hugh Jackman was saying, this is the last time I will be Logan... Patrick Stewart was saying, this is my last performance as Professor X.
And what a performance it was.
Yeah. No, I reckon we're getting a completely brand new cast.
Yeah.
Slightly left field choice that I think I saw on a list somewhere. It's actually Colin Salmon. He is, I'm not sure like where you'd know him from that well, because he's kind of, not a background actor, but like a, you know, kind of supporting role type guy for lots of things. He was like one of the government people in like the Piers Brosnan, James Bond movies.
All right, okay.
Actually, I suppose where people probably might know him best from is he was in the first few seasons of Arrow as like Moira Queen's husband.
Ah, him. That might actually be an interesting choice.
Yeah, mainly because I think he has got like the bald look and more importantly, the eyebrows down pat.
Yes, he does. Yes, he does.
Listen, to be honest, I think in like kind of a cynical marketing perspective, having a black actor play Professor X, I think helps with the idea of not just seeing them as like discount Patrick Stewart.
Yeah. And the thing is, I know that historically Professor X has always been white, you know, but nobody has ever said that he couldn't be black.
Yeah, I mean, he is a character who you can very easily change the race of.
Yeah.
I mean, like, to be honest, like, 90% of white characters.
Yeah.
And the great thing is,
yeah,
because of the subtle themes of X-Men, absolutely no one will have any sort of negative response to this in the slightest.
Well, you say that.
I say that. I lie. I lie a lot.
So, yeah, Professor X.
So that's Professor X.
Yeah.
I think that the real tricky prospect,
yeah,
is what do you do with Magneto?
Ooh, yeah.
Here's the thing. These films are going to be coming out in, like, the 2020s.
Yeah.
Physically, even with the suspension of disbelief of a comic book world, I don't see how you can have Magneto, who is a Holocaust survivor.
Yeah. Unless you basically put it back so it was set in, say, the 1980s or the 1970s.
Yeah, I guess, but that's just, for me, that's too much what the X-Men, what the Fox X-Men films are doing.
Yeah, I know.
I feel like that's not something you especially like want to just retread.
Then again, there is try this idea on for size, right? Just throwing this out there. Wild idea, I know, but the Marvel Universe has already gone cosmic, yeah?
Yeah.
With Infinity War. So what if they do, and I'm going to bring this forward. What if they do the Fantastic Four first, right? And so they use the Fantastic Four movie, because the Fantastic Four are explorers and they've been to the microverse and explored with the Micronauts and everyone else. And they've been to other dimensions. And what if, and they've been to parallel universes as well. And what if they use the Fantastic Four to basically break the dimensional walls and basically open up the idea of parallel universes within the Marvel Universe. And then they have the X-Men as refugees from their universe.
I really don't like that, to be honest.
I'm not saying it's a great idea.
I feel like that's too much, putting more stuff on the X-Men's plate than there needs to be.
The only reason I'm thinking that is because of what happened at the beginning of X-Men Gold or whatever it was, when Kitty Pryde brought everyone back in the mansion in the middle of Manhattan in Central Park, basically squatting. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
And you know what the executives tend to be like with comic book movies?
No, I don't really get the point you're trying to make here.
Basically, what I'm thinking is that if they wanted to save time and effort and money, right? If you look at the movies, the X-Men movies that were already made, like Days of Future Past, yeah?
Yeah.
Where they ostensibly sent Wolverine back in time to rewrite history. And what I'm thinking is, what if they basically use the Fantastic Four movie to basically introduce the idea of parallel universes, and then in the X-Men movie, they have the Fox X-Men characters universe jumping into the Marvel Universe?
No, again, I'm adamant that they are just absolutely not going to use the Fox stuff.
I don't think they'll use the Fox stuff either, but I'm throwing it out there because that is one of the strange ideas that someone's probably going to come up with.
Yeah, see, just the problem with that for me is then that makes the X-Men, their whole deal is the fact that they're like refugees from another universe.
Yeah.
Rather than like the whole mutants fighting against the world that hates and fears them.
Yeah, I know. That's why that's the main reason I don't think that's going to happen. But, you know.
Yeah, it's just, that's not the X-Men.
Yeah, I know it's not the X-Men, but right now, the whole refugee crisis thing, some executive somewhere is going, oh, we can do this.
No, even for executives, that's too convoluted.
They allowed Thor the Dark World to be made.
I mean, that wasn't convoluted. That was just not very good.
Yes, that's what I mean.
They wasted Christopher Eccleston and Malekith the Dark Elf.
Yeah.
That makes me sad.
And we've seen what DC executives are capable of.
Great evil.
And so that's why I'm not writing off that bad idea. But anyway, back to what we think. What we hope. Sorry.
Yeah, because kind of the idea I have in my head for an X-Men movie...
Yeah.
Is sort of, you introduced the idea that mutants, there's like a big mutant scare in like, say, the 1970s, at which point kind of Charles Xavier and Eric, what's his bobs? I've forgotten Magneto's last name.
Lensher,
that's it. They kind of appear on the scene and they start, you know, kind of setting up the Xavier School as sort of a way to, you know, sort of help take mutants out of a particularly volatile situation and sort of train them up in safety so that they can, you know, blend in with the normal world.
Yeah.
Then sort of flash forward to present day, where mutants are now more like sort of an urban legend, but people are sort of aware of this weird school in upstate New York where no one really knows anyone who goes there, and it just seems like they sort of pick kids at random.
Hmm.
And so that's how you introduce the idea of the X-Men existing in this universe. And then maybe you get someone like Kitty Pryde. And, you know, she, like, on her 16th birthday discovers, oh no, I can fall through objects. At which point Professor X just kind of rocks up her house and says, hey, you're a mutant, come to our fun mutant school. So she goes, she kind of enrolls in the school, meets the actual X-Men who sort of, you know, try and help mutant kind and keep their existence a secret from the wider world. But then Magneto, you know, he is like the villain and he decides, no, we shouldn't have to live in secrets. You know, I'm going to expose mutant kind to the world and, you know, prove that we are, you know, rightful rulers. So you've got the X-Men, you know, they've got to stop Magneto from, I don't know, launching nukes or whatever, because that's what he did in like, his first comic.
Yeah.
So they do that, but like during the course of that, the world finds out, oh, wait, no, mutants do actually exist.
Yeah. I see where you're going for that. I like it up to a point, but for Magneto, just suddenly being the villain because he's always been the villain, that's the bit I'm a bit unsure of.
Well, look, see, in my mind, what you want is film one, you want Magneto to just be the straight up villain, but with like fairly sympathetic reasons.
Yeah, that's what I'm
then, like, after that, in like the later movies, then you can have something where like he slowly more comes over to the X-Men side.
I'm not talking about not making him the villain, you know, but it's the reasons why he's the villain is what I'm wondering about. Because I think just, you know... Just...
Yeah, so actually, because this, I like, did have an idea for Magneto, which goes back to the idea of, well, you can't really make him a Holocaust survivor.
Yeah.
Because A, then he'd be like 100 years old.
Yeah.
And B, I feel like, because World War II in the Marvel Universe, I feel like they skimmed over a lot of the really bad details.
They did.
And that's still kind of too light of a universe to really go into that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So in my mind, instead of like that, what you instead have in this universe is Magneto is like maybe, say, during the 1980s or something, it was actually Hydra that like came in and they like killed his wife and kid and then did a bunch of experiments on him. Because obviously at this time, like in the MCU, Hydra had infiltrated S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah, there is that. That would tie into it. You've just
given... And it works, because then obviously you can have Magneto be fairly understandably be like, okay, fine, you say that like S.H.I.E.L.D. now isn't Hydra, but you still look like the same people to me who did all these horrific things to me.
You've just given me an idea, right? Just give me a wild idea, another wild idea, admittedly. But try this on for size, right? It does kind of fit around what you've said. It doesn't involve Hydra, but it does kind of fit around. Because initially, while you were talking, I was thinking, you know, there's all these superbugs and viruses going around. There's Ebola and things like that. And we're always terrified of some worldwide pandemic. Yeah?
Yeah.
So what if Magneto and Xavier and a bunch of other people were survivors of that, some viral outbreak, which changed them. They mutated. Their bodies mutated as a defense mechanism. That is a possibility, you know?
Okay, but then...
But then there's no tragedy, there's no reason, there's no justification for Magneto's becoming the bad guy.
Yeah, and also more, like, then how do more mutants spring up?
Well, this is the thing. That's what got me onto the second bit. For more mutants springing up, which is Infinity War. And what I was thinking was, you know, half the population has been wiped out.
Yeah.
They're going to bring them back, aren't they?
I mean, I would hope so.
Well, they're going to bring back Spider-Man and Spider-Man Black Panther.
Spider-Man Far From Home is going to be pretty weird if Peter Parker's dead.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. They're going to find a way to reset things. But what I was thinking was, what if it's not a perfect reset? What if for a perfect reset, you'd have to have Thanos undoing what he did? So if somebody else did it, there'd be aberration. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess you could kind of, maybe even just like offhandedly mention that. That maybe reality getting like stitched back together is suddenly why there's like recorded mutants in history when there maybe wasn't before.
Or why mutants are suddenly appearing because, you know, reality has literally been stitched back together and people's bodies are mutating.
Yeah, but I guess the thing with that, though, is then that means that mutants are like a new thing once that has happened. So the X-Men movie would have to be like the X-Men's origin.
Yeah, and what I'm thinking is the big...
I'd much rather just have the X-Men be like an established thing in the MCU that just like no one's really come into contact with yet.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think outside the box a little bit here, because I'm thinking if they did it as kind of a follow-on from Infinity War and had Infinity War be the reason for, or the Infinity War in the movie that comes after be the reason for the existence of mutants in the first place, then the whole thing about half the population being wiped out could be a trigger point for Magneto to be the bad guy. I know, it's convoluted and cumbersome, I know.
It is. Plus, it goes against, like, what my two probably hard rules are for an X-Men reboot.
Mm.
Just, number one, please, dear God, don't make an origin movie.
Yes.
No more origin movies.
Oh, God, yes. That's why you
there's a bad thing, and we need to get all these people together, but, oh, they don't know how to work with each other. But maybe by the end of the film, they'll learn that their true superpower is friendship.
Yes. That's why I liked Spider-Man Homecoming. It wasn't an origin movie.
Yeah, and I feel like Marvel know that people have reacted quite well to stuff like that. I like Black Panther as well, where his origin story was about like 5 minutes of Civil War II, where he's just like, well, father's dead, better be Black Panther.
Yeah, but Black Panther was...
That's all you need.
Yeah, but the thing is, with the Black Panther movie, it also established that Black Panther wasn't a new character. Black Panther was an old character stretching back hundreds of years.
Yeah, and then... Also, my second thing with the X-Men is I very much want them kind of like the Guardians of the Galaxy, where they're just off in their own little corner.
Okay, yeah, I get that.
Because I think the X-Men work very well as just their own sort of almost separate thing. But then maybe when, like, I don't know, Kree-Skrull War or whatever the next, like, big Marvel thing is, then they can kind of appear in that.
Okay, yeah, all right.
But I don't want them, like, constantly popping in and out, like, maybe Captain America's popping over for a cup of tea. I don't need that in my X-Men. Speaking of the X-Men, and there's like 50 billion of them, so which X-Men would you want to see like as a sort of initial roster?
Initial roster has to include Cyclops, Jean Grey.
Oh yeah, definitely. I would say like Cyclops, Jean Grey, and also probably Wolverine.
I'm actually hesitant about having Wolverine in at the beginning. I think bring him in, you could look at bringing him into the team during the movie, but I don't think he should be in the team right at the beginning. You remember the very first X-Men movie?
Yeah, because I mean that's in my mind why maybe start with Wolverine on the team, just then so again, it's not like the first X-Men movie all over again.
Yeah, this is true. Then again, if they're off doing their own thing, then you could start with him on the team as it is. I do think Beast needs to be on the team because he's been one of the founding members for, you know, since like day one. I think it was just in that first X-Men movie that he wasn't a founding member, was he?
Yeah, because then in First Class, like, he became a fan. Although I think, like, even in that continuity, he was a founding member but had left the team by the time the first X-Men movie happened.
Yeah.
But I would, in my mind, Beast is on that team as well.
Well, they need somebody who's good with the technology.
Yeah, I mean, basically, that is like one of the rules of superhero films, is you need a science guy.
Yeah, you need a science guy, and in this case, the science guy is also the muscle, you know? So Beast and Wolverine, Bobby Drake?
Yeah, sure, because I mean, like, I have a pretty firm team set in my mind.
See, Bobby Drake is a founding member of the original X-Men, and I'd like to see him as a founding member of Marvel's X-Men as well.
Yeah. See, actually, like in the vision I've got in my head,
yeah,
he isn't a founding member.
Oh,
because it's like so. Like I said, in my mind, Kitty Pryde would be the main character.
Yeah,
because it'd be kind of her getting introduced to the X-Men, and through that, the audience get introduced to the X-Men. So the actual like X-Men team itself is Cyclops, Jean Grey, Wolverine, and Beast. Oh, and Storm as well.
Yeah,
because I feel like those are kind of the five big X-Men, then also Colossus, but as sort of like the kid member of that X-Men team and the one who Kitty Pryde has a crush on. And yeah. So like Kitty would end up sneaking on the X-Men's mission with her best friend and fellow classmate Bobby Drake. And that's just, I think that's a fun dynamic.
See, Kitty and Bobby have always had a fun relationship. I do like that idea.
Especially now, like, I do like the idea of Iceman being Kitty Pryde's like gay best friend.
Yeah, he totally fits that mold, and the thing is, he's always fitted that mold as well when you think about their relationship.
Yeah, well, which is why I think like his coming out in the comics was kind of one of those no-duh moments.
Yeah. I mean, it does kind of... who was the guy who played him in the first movie? In the first trilogy?
Sean something, I think. I was going to say Sean Astin, but no, that's a Samwise Gamgee.
Yeah. I mean, he plays a great Two-Flower, but I'm not sure about Gay Iceman.
Movie played by Sean Ashmore.
Close.
Yeah, he's a Sean. Different spelling of Sean.
Yeah.
And then the last name start with A.
Yeah, true. Yeah, I like that idea. I like that idea a lot. See, with the X-Men movie, do you know what I'd love to see it as, right? You know how Spider-Man Homecoming was... you know how Ant-Man was a heist movie, yeah?
Yeah.
And Spider-Man Homecoming was, it was basically Peter Parker desperately trying to prove his worth to Tony Stark.
Yeah, well, while taking part in, like, a John Hughes movie.
Yeah, basically. If we follow what you've described, right, I'd love to see the X-Men movie as kind of a Ferris Bueller's Day Off type superhero movie.
Yeah, because, like, I do have that in my mind as kind of the, oh man, class is boring, but we don't need this. I bet we can be real superheroes.
Yeah.
Let's sneak aboard the Blackbird and help the X-Men take on Magneto.
Yeah, basically. And so you'll have like the X-Men doing their thing just off to one side, but most of the action is on Kitty and Bobby just getting into all sorts of wacky hijinks. Yeah. I don't think we need any musical numbers.
Also, in my mind, I have like at least one amazing sight gag.
Oh?
Which is like, so obviously they're fighting Magneto and his like brotherhood.
Yeah.
So I imagine it's like Jean Grey versus Mastermind, and they're having like this big psychic battle. Well, like, you know, all the landscape is, like, shifting and warping, and like, they're turning into giant flaming birds and, like, big dark giants.
Yeah.
And smash cut to Kitty and Bobby, they're watching, and Jean Grey and Mastermind just stood there staring at each other. And, like, just Jean and Bobby, like, they're just, like, tilting their heads, just, what's going on?
See, that works for me. And that's something that I don't think is done enough in superhero movies, especially when you're dealing with psychics.
It is, because I feel like that's just that is a very good joke.
Yes.
Also, what I really want with Iceman is like his arc to be, he starts off where all he can do is like make snowballs.
Yes. Yeah.
But like, obviously, he will have a big moment where, like, I don't know, Juggernaut, but probably not Juggernaut, so some generic like big strong dude is about to like pummel one of the X-Men, and so he just splats him in the face with a snowball.
I think that if you, you know, with the snowball, right, I think his next power, his next fearsome ability will be the ability to create a little patch of ice right under someone's foot.
Yeah. I like that, like, the idea he starts off to be able to do, like, just dumb pranks.
Yeah. And the little patch of ice...
Oh, he's just gets more and more powerful.
Yeah, but the little patch of ice is, like, his first, you know, proper ice ability is just that little patch of ice. And he uses it to play pranks, but then he uses it one time to save one of the X-Men from Juggernaut. It's like Juggernaut's running as fast as he can. And he goes, no, patch of ice. And then all of a sudden Juggernaut just slips and just careens into a wall or something like that.
See, that actually works really well, because the whole thing is nothing can stop the Juggernaut.
Except a little patch of ice.
Just, like, make that ice patch underneath him, and he just goes sliding off into the distance.
Yes.
So, yeah, because I feel like, this is what I'm kind of excited about for the X-Men in the MCU.
Yeah.
Is I do want them to bring in, like, a bit more humour.
Yes.
It's probably, like, as someone who does like the Fox X-Men films, my main issue with them probably is that they're always very serious.
Yeah. And they had flashes.
Which, I mean, like, because to be fair, that is every movie, every action movie from, like, the early to mid-2000s is everything is most serious.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why 80s action movies are so beloved, is that they knew there were dumb movies, you know? Everybody knew an 80s action movie was just a big, dumb, stupid movie, which
yeah.
is why
well,
we
could
enjoy it.
They fundamentally knew that audiences want to watch these movies to have fun.
Yeah.
Like, Tango and Cash is definitely not a serious examination of the human condition.
No, it's not. And, you know, there's nothing we can say about Die Hard, which is apparently still the best 80s action movie of all time.
I mean, I feel like I can't really argue with that.
You know? I mean, he writes on a t-shirt, now I have a machine gun, ho ho ho.
Can you imagine, like, Oh, I was going to say, can you imagine early 2000s Die Hard? But yes, you can, because it's called Die Hard 4.
Yes, where they lost the ability to make humour and instead thought, ooh, I'll kill this helicopter with this car. But anyway, I think we've found a solution for X-Men.
We have. We've also like got most of the way through the show and not even touched upon the Fantastic Four.
So how about next week we do Fantastic Four?
Yeah, that surprise everyone, this is a two-parter.
Yes, so tune in next week for that. But anyway, we're going to take a break there because we've got comics to go through.
We do indeed.
Hello, fellow Vault Hunters. I'm J. Michael Tatum, and you're listening to The Geek Show.
Ah, there really is nothing like a first leather-bound edition of a classic Victorian podcast. Hello, we're Literally Loitering from The Geek Show, and we cover literally all types of books, from hardbacks to paperbacks to sometimes the words within them. If any of these things interest you, why not pop in and give us a visit on Literally Loitering.
If you've enjoyed the show, then you can find all of our other shows on Apple Podcasts, Audioboom, or on our website where we have a range of other shows that might suit your taste. Try them out, you never know. We also have our shop, we have our Patreon, and we have all sorts of other things for you to enjoy on our site, thegeekshow.co.uk. If you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on Facebook or on our own Twitter, which is Andrew.
At 4PowerPodcast.
Or you can email us, studio@thegeekshow.co.uk.
Hi, I'm Dave from Geek Corner. What you should do, if you like comics, is get yourselves along to our cool little comic book shop in Stockton-on-Tees in the Regency West Mall, where we stock a range of really cool independent comics. We actually have some really unique stuff that we are the only shop in the world to stock. You should definitely come along and check it out. Thanks very much, and get yourselves down to Stockton-on-Tees.
And welcome back, everybody. Next up on the all-new, all-different four-panel is that same bit that we had in the old four-panel, because this hasn't changed that much. It's what we've been reading.
Yes.
Rob, answer the question.
What have I been reading?
What have you been reading?
Well, I have been reading something that I reckon you should have covered, but I'm going to cover it anyway, because this is Rome West by Justin Giampaoli, Brian Wood and Andrea Mutti, and it is, you remember a while ago, you on Literary Loitering, you covered a book called Eagle and Empire.
Oh yeah, what was it, like a whole trilogy of those books where it's basically what if the Roman Empire never collapsed and they ended up invading sort of North America?
Yeah, this is kind of like that, right? This is a what if story of Rome West, and this what if is basically, it begins in 323 AD off the coast of Hispania, and it starts on the Roman galley ship of Orsi, and the first chapter is the Great Western Sea and the Eastern Woodlands. And the Roman galley ship Orsi and a couple of other ships are involved in a massive storm, and they're adrift at sea, and then weeks later they find themselves at a place they call Hill Island, where they meet Native American tribes. And the survivors of the galley ships, the Roman soldiers, they attack first, but then they make peace with this tribe, and they basically decide to settle there because they don't know how to get home. They don't know where they are.
Okay, nice. So this is like a very similar concept, but instead of an organized invasion, they've just got like blown off course.
Yeah. And so they make a deal with the native Lenape tribe, and they trade their metalworking ability and various other things for land and settlements and stuff like that. And then they basically merge with the Lenape tribe, and then the scene changes to 847 AD, the city of Valseneca, which is Rochester, New York. And at this point, you have looks like a Roman Republic, but it's intermingled with Native Americans. And this continues on through 990 AD and various other moments in history, in the history of the Roman Empire as it is in America. So when they fight off the Vikings, when Columbus lands and thinks that he's the first person to find America, only to find Romans are there and they're speaking Latin. But these Romans, these Native American Romans, they're not dumb. They know that Columbus is only the beginning and that there will be an army of conquest behind him. So they capture Columbus instead of allowing...
And subject him to horrible, horrible tortures.
They lock him in prison. And so when the Spanish and everyone else from Europe decides to try and invade America, they have this phrase saying, "Remember Columbus." So obviously Columbus hasn't met a good end.
You know, you had me at terrible things happen to Christopher Columbus.
Yeah.
That guy was super racist.
Yes, he was. And he is super racist in this, only to find out that these Roman Native Americans, they're not idiots. And they're a lot smarter than him. He's bemoaning the fact that he wasn't the first to discover America. They're going, yeah, bring it on. And then the scene shifts. This is where it deviates from, it's already deviated wildly from what we expected, but this is where it deviates again. It goes to 1545, and they're using guns in 1545. They're using sniper rifles, in fact, and they're fighting against the Aztecs and various others, and then it keeps going through time up to what is relatively modern day. Now, each of these stories is basically a snapshot in time, a snapshot in history. And it focuses in particular on the Valerius family, who seem to be one of the mainstays of this west of Rome West. And they, you know, they're a family who seems to be progressive, but as time goes by, as the centuries roll on, the Valerius family becomes more and more diluted, and you know, the bloodline continues to be important, and you see that in one of the stories. Just how much importance they place on bloodline and breeding and things like that. And so it was an interesting read. I've got to admit, I would have really have liked this to have been longer, you know, to have been more in depth, because this is a fascinating alternative history, you know?
Yeah, cause, I mean, I think that was like my thing with those Eagle and Empire books. It's like I got to the end and thought, but like now I want a comprehensive timeline of like, what does America look like now that, you know, the Native Americans are actually like a superpower.
Yeah. And this is kind of an answer to that, I suppose, but not enough of an answer, I think. The artwork is all right for the most part. There are some panels that I didn't like, but in general, it's pretty good. It's got kind of a sketchy style to the line work.
Okay. Yeah. Kind of.
I'm not on about like a rough sketch. It's not like those underground comics, but you know, it does have a lot of clear lines, but the lines are, you know, well, when I say clear lines, but they're kind of rough lines at the same time. It's kind of half and half, which gives it that sketchy look. And the colours aren't kind of bold and bright. There is some colour blends at times, which, you know, it sometimes works, sometimes doesn't work. It's not like your normal superhero comics where you have a definite black line around things. You see what I mean?
Yeah, it's not like clearly defined. Gerardo Sandoval, that's the guy's name.
Yeah.
But he's the guy I was thinking of who does, like, quite good, sort of fairly sketchy art.
Yeah. I mean, I've got to say, the cover is very, very striking. The cover is very, very striking of a woman with braided hair and ear piercings and a nose piercing. And she looks kind of Native American in profile, but you know, she's wearing a coat and she's carrying a bag, but behind her is this Roman fresco, but it's all in kind of red, white and blue and black. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, it does sound quite cool. I might have to take it off your hands.
Yeah. So, Rome West, it's really good for what it is, but I really want more.
Oh. I mean, do you know, are they putting any more out?
Well, I have it on good authority because it does actually say it on this. This is industry insider Justin Giampoli. It's his writing debut alongside acclaimed creative team Brian Wood and Andrea Mutti.
Of course, so hopefully they'll make more of it then.
Hopefully, yeah. Anyway, over to you.
Yeah, so this is awkward because basically, you know how we talked about Fantastic Four earlier?
Yeah.
And by earlier, I mean next show.
Don't worry.
But this is why I read Marvel 2-in-1, The Thing and the Human Torch.
It's all right.
To get that good synergy going.
We got stuck on X-Men, okay? So yeah, don't worry.
Welcome to Four Panel, everyone. The more things change, the more things stay the same. So this is Volume 1, Fate of the Four. It is written by Chip Zdarsky, with art by Jim Chung and Valerio Schiti.
Okay.
And this concerns... It's kind of a weird read, because now that we know the Fantastic Four are back in comics...
Yeah.
Because this came out kind of a few months back, before we really knew what was going on with the Fantastic Four. So this is about the Thing and the Human Torch, who are kind of the two remaining members after Secret Wars. Basically, they're trying to deal with the fact that there isn't a Fantastic Four anymore. So it starts with looking at our characters, Johnny Storm. He's not doing too well. He's basically, you see him as a stock car driver, and he's taking all sorts of unnecessary risks now because he might have a bit of a death wish going. Meanwhile, Ben Grimm, he's basically like the Fantastic Four representative now, though he's going to like all charity dinners and stuff. But you can kind of tell that deep down he's sort of, I mean, he's a bit sad that he's lost pretty much his entire family.
See, I always liked, I mean, we've made no secret that we like Ben Grimm as a character. And
he is like one of, if not my favourite, Marvel, if not comic character.
I mean, what I like about Ben Grimm is, you know, okay, we got sent Old Man Hawkeye, right? And I don't know why Marvel is currently doing their old man thing. I don't know who in Marvel has an old man fetish. You remember we did Princess Jellyfish, and there was the old man Otaku in that?
Yes, she is like now in charge of one of Marvel's editorial divisions.
Yeah, that's what I think is going on. So, but you've got Ben Grimm, who is quite proverbially Marvel's old man, Marvel's kind of dumb but wise old man.
Yes, and I think that works, like, especially with the art, because he's always got like this really like heavy hanging over brow and these sort of tired, droopy eyes.
Yeah,
and like I think this book does do like a really great job of making him just like look like this tired old man.
See, that's what I love about, because I read the Marvel 2-in-1 when it was out originally, you know, months ago. And what I liked about it was the idea that he's just tired now, you know. But then I look at Old Man Logan and I look at Old Man Hawkeye, I'm going, isn't that just like they just put like white hair and a beard on them?
Yeah, that they are basically Guy Pearce and Prometheus.
Yeah.
But anyway, this... kind of the story itself kicks off with Ben Grimm being approached by Spider-Man, who, to go back even a bit further post-Secret Wars, Spider-Man was briefly like a millionaire, and he bought the Baxter Building, but now he's gone bankrupt, so he's basically like handing Ben sort of a locker of all the Fantastic Four's old stuff. So basically what he finds in this locker is a hologram from Reed, basically saying, like, you know, don't give up. You are like the Fantastic Four's legacy. You need to keep exploring. So here's like a device that can cross multiverses. And Ben takes that and kind of feeling a lot of guilt, he kind of goes to try and check in on Johnny because they've sort of drifted apart. And he sees that, you know, Johnny, he's really not good. He's kind of taken all these huge risks. Doesn't really care if he lives or dies. Also, his powers seem to be a bit on the fritz. So what happens is... Ben ends up lying to him, and he says that, you know, he got given this multiverse crossing device because Reed and Sue are out there somewhere and we need to find them. So it's just like this big multiverse popping adventure. But I just love that, like, this undercurrent that it's all built on, well, at least the Thing thinks is a lie, because in his mind, no, he knows Reed and Sue, they're dead and gone. But like, this is literally like the only thing he can think of to tell Johnny, like, to pull him out of the spiral.
Yeah. The thing about that Marvel 2-in-1, the thing that I kind of love about it is that it did have that bittersweet undertone to it, didn't it?
Yeah, well, I think just in general, the Thing is one of those very bittersweet characters.
Yeah.
Because it's just like him learning to deal with the fact that he's like a 7-foot orange rock monster.
Yeah, this is true. This is true. But then spin on a few months. Fantastic Four number one.
Yeah, but which again is like, it makes it weird because reading this already knowing that, oh yeah, this is kind of pointless because the Fantastic Four are coming back.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's pointless. I think that there is. I think that they did this on purpose. I'm really curious to see how they play the Fantastic Four. You know, what kind of story are they going to bring to the table here? Because they've done that Marvel 2-in-1, which was bittersweet and kind of had a note of finality about it.
Yeah. I mean, like, don't get me wrong. I do really like this series. It's a ton of fun because, I mean, like, they go to an alternate universe where Doctor Doom has taken over the body of Galactus and eaten everything in the universe except for Earth.
Hmm.
It's great. It's just, it is kind of weird knowing that this is going to end in, like, them definitively not finding the Fantastic Four.
Yeah. Which brings us back to that Fantastic Four number one, which I'm not sure how I feel about that first issue. I think the first issue ended really well.
Yeah, I think the weird thing is that they probably should have marketed that as something like a zero issue or a prelude issue.
Yeah.
Because, not to spoil it, but like Reed and Sue don't even really appear in that issue except for like a couple of panels.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, look, the point I want to get across is, even with what I'm saying, Marvel 2-in-1 is tremendously fun.
Yes.
Like, it's really good. It's characters that I love, because also, like, they are joined in their adventures by Doctor Doom, like, back when he was basically Iron Man. A new character called Rachna Cole, who, like, is a scientist that gives people superpowers. She's pretty cool, but she doesn't really do much in these first six issues. And much more importantly, in the issue where they meet Rachna, they team up with Hercules.
Awesome.
Who is just at his most just happy-go-lucky dude bro.
Oh, you mean Brocules?
Yes.
Or Hercubro, as some people call him.
Which is wrong. It is Brocules. Yes. That is his name. Also, I like that now he drinks like Stark brand alcohol-free beer.
Yes. But yeah, Brocules is... He's always been one of my kind of what's the word? I wouldn't say he's my favorite Marvel character, but he's always been one of my Marvel characters where I put him on the shelf and just say, you know, he's a lot of fun whenever he's around.
Yeah, he brightens up any comic he's in.
You know where he is. He's the life of the party. That's where he is.
He is, and because who else is the life of the party? Is Chip Zdarsky?
Yeah,
because he is very good at writing like fun, snappy dialogue, but he really seems to get like the heart of the Fantastic Four.
Yes.
You know, they are a family and they need each other.
Yeah.
And it also makes me really glad that apparently this series is actually continuing.
Awesome.
Like, and it's maybe going to like run alongside the Fantastic Four series, which if it is just like a return to the old school Marvel 2-in-1, the thing just like teaming up with random heroes, be 100% down for that.
Yes. Please do that. Please don't do the thing just suddenly appearing in Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur.
Yeah.
Although also, he was the best thing in that issue of Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur.
He was the best. But also, what I want to give a shout out to, like specifically the Incas and colour artist for this.
Oh.
Where the Incas are John Dell, Walden Wong. Yeah, John Dell and Walden Wong, and the colour artist is Frank Martin.
Okay.
Because they do some amazing stuff with Jim Chung's art. Awesome. I feel like Jim Chung, he is one of the artists who does need like good inkers and colourists to really make his art pop. Sometimes it can feel a little bit blocky, but this is just, you know, absolutely beautiful. And like, contrary to his last name, Sheety does some really nice art as well. I'm glad that's actually true so that I can make that joke. But yeah, no, it's really nice. It's like bright and colourful and expressive. It's just some good comic books.
Awesome. You know, you mentioned Doctor Doom.
I did mention Doctor Doom.
When he was in his Iron Man phase.
Yes, indeed he was.
Well, that conveniently leads me on to The Invincible Iron Man, The Search for Tony Stark, which is basically... It collects Invincible Iron Man 2016, number 593 to number 600 by Brian Michael Bendis, Stefano Caselli, Alex Maleev, Marta Gracia, Israel Silva, and more, according to the back.
So many more.
Yes. Now, On the cover of this, on the cover of this trade paperback, it actually says, "Great words, great art, great comic by Comicosity." And I will say right now, you know, I disagree.
Le gasp.
Yes, le gasp. Now, I've been reading Iron Man, right? I like Riri Williams as Ironheart. I liked the whole idea of Tony Stark, and I think it would have been very bold if they basically killed off Tony Stark. But no, they had to Superman him.
Oh, yeah, death of Superman. He has to go in his special coma.
Oh, no, he has to go in his special coma. That's the first thing where... that's the first kind of parallel with Superman. There are more. There are parallels with Superman, and you remember Nightfall, where Bane broke Batman's back, and then, you know, you had Nightfall where, you know, where Azrael became Batman, you know, and then you had Night Quest where Bruce Wayne went on some journey.
Yeah, I never really thought, but this is basically the Iron Man version of that, isn't it?
Yes. And the problem I've got here is that I'm pretty sure that whoever reviewed this for Comicosity has never read that. Unfortunately, I have, right? So, what you have...
I really like how you're specifically going against this one reviewer.
Well, it's the one that it's the one that's right on the cover. And don't get me wrong, right? And I know that's an oxymoron to say don't get me wrong, right? But don't get me wrong. There are some great ideas in this comic. There are some great things in this comic. There's some great artwork in this comic. There are some great moments of dialogue in this comic. But the fundamental thing is that this comic is just more than a little bit stupid, right? For
what? Comic books being stupid?
Well, here's the thing, right? And this is one of the bits that I really didn't like about this. I'm going to go over the bits that I liked about it first, right? I like the idea that Riri Williams is trying to become something more than just, you know, a shadow of Tony Stark, yeah? I like the fact that Blade makes an appearance in this, you know?
Blade.
Blade makes an appearance in this.
Yeah.
I like the fact that, you know, you have some superhero team-ups and various things like that. There are all sorts of things going on. I like the fact that, you know, there are these shocking revelations, some of which are surprising. What I like the fact of most of all is Dr. Doom, during his Iron Man phase, was trying to be a good guy, and nobody seems to understand why. Yeah?
Yeah.
But they...
I kind of like the idea that sometimes Dr. Doom just, like, wants to be a good guy, but then he'll get kind of sick of it and just, like, realize, oh, no way, I can be much more efficient by just being evil.
Well, actually, I kind of get the idea of why he's trying to be a good guy, because it is touched on in this trade paperback, right? And it's because he's going to be a dad.
That's a curveball.
Yeah. See, here's the thing. He's donning the Iron Man armor, and he's kind of taken Tony Stark's place as kind of the global do-gooder in a big suit of armor. And the reason, and I reckon the reason is because there's some woman called Amara, and she's basically pregnant with Doctor Doom's kid.
Oh, he wants to be a good dad.
But anyway,
see, he's a nice, horrible tyrant and dictator deep down.
Well, this is the thing. We'll get to that in a second. Anyway. Tony Stark's mum, the country and western singer who's, you know, really popular, apparently is not everything that she seems. Tony Stark is adopted. Didn't see that ball coming.
Yeah, that was a thing that came out a little while ago. Iron Man comics have had some weird plot lines over, like, the past few years.
Yeah, I mean, there is this kind of dialogue between Tony Stark and his dad, who's dead. You know, this is Tony Stark hallucinating. And rationalizing his dad's behavior. And his dad basically points out to him that, this is one of the bits that I really liked was Tony Stark's dad standing there saying, "I watched you suffer. Is that what I did? I didn't raise you from birth. I didn't give you a name, my name and fortune. I didn't protect you from demons of your past. You had no say in creating. So the least I could do was spare you them. When you were 9, I didn't stay up with you when you were sick with a fever so bad I thought I was watching you die. I didn't give you every opportunity in the damn world to make the most of yourself and of your God-given brilliance. Yeah, I was hard on you. You hit the jackpot in life, and I wanted to make sure you did something with it. And now you're Iron Man." That bit I love.
That does seem very against the origin of Iron Man, though.
It is very against the origin of Iron Man. Because Tony Stark's real dad makes an appearance in this as well. You know, the Hydra agent that his mum stabbed in the neck?
Oh, right. Like, real biological dad, not Howard Stark.
Yeah, not Howard Stark, his real biological dad, who his mum stabbed in the neck with a pair of scissors.
Sure.
Yeah. Meanwhile, there's some guy called Palmer Robbins who's going around gathering supervillains to try and take down Dr. Doom and conquer Tony Stark's business empire, while somebody else business... Sorry?
I think that's the Hood.
Parker Robbins, yeah, the Hood. Yeah. He's basically trying to take down Dr. Doom, who's been going around as Global Do-Gooder. Riri Williams and the rest of them are looking for Iron Man and looking for Tony. Tony said, no, don't look for me. So obviously he's still alive, even though everyone thinks he's dead. He's only missing. And there's some guy who's trying to conquer Tony, who's trying to take Tony Stark's business empire away from Tony Stark's mom, using the board of directors, yada, yada, yada. It all gets convoluted, and then Leonardo da Vinci turns up.
Oh, yeah, that's another, like, weird casual thing in the Marvel Universe, that Leonardo da Vinci is, like, an immortal super spy.
Yeah, not only is he an immortal super spy, he's the creator of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yes, he is.
And he is also able to remotely control Riri Williams' Ironheart suit.
Because he's Leonardo da Vinci, greatest inventor ever made.
Yeah. There's that. And what else? Oh, yeah. Now to the bad part. What I hate about this is what they did to Doctor Doom, right? What I hate about this is basically they took the whole idea of Doctor Doom being a good guy and actually trying to do some good with his life, and they basically tore his face off because he's using some forbidden spell which humans aren't supposed to use, and he went up against some supernatural bad guy who ripped his face off and left him severely injured, so he can't ever meet his kid anymore, and now Doom is a tragic character.
Oh, okay, that's how he ended up, like, back in that area for Fantastic Four 1.
Yes.
Okay, cool. And plus, I guess that is also the explanation of, hey, the Fantastic Four are coming back, we need Dr. Doom back in the old villain role.
Yeah, I know, and I hate that. I hate the fact that that's one of the things that I really don't like, is the idea that Dr. Doom has to be the villain, you know?
I just in general hate what happens all the time in comics where it's like, nope, we're going to just throw away all that character development.
Yeah, and it was, in Doom's case, you know, what you got to see was actually pretty interesting. I mean, he gets surrounded by bad guys Palmer Robinson. Is it Parker or Palmer? I can't remember.
Parker.
He basically gets Wrecker to pry open Dr. Doom's armor. So Doom teleports to the only place he feels safe, which is Amara's apartment. Amara being the woman who's pregnant with his child. He doesn't actually think about where he's teleporting. It's instinct. And he explains to her he didn't intentionally go there. It was instinctual.
No, that's not Dr. Doom.
Yeah. But apparently he's used some spell on himself to restore his body. So, yeah, I know. As far as I'm concerned, Doom has always been calculating and cold and callous. And I found
Dr. Doom is the guy who, like, has a special bunker pre-prepared that he can teleport to in case of emergencies.
Yeah, and in this case, he teleported to that apartment, which I didn't quite buy, but, they did sell it pretty decently in this.
Yeah, I don't... Like, it's just like, I can understand characters making dumb emotional decisions, but, like, kind of the point of Doctor Doom is that he doesn't do dumb stuff like that.
Yeah, but, I mean, the way they sold it in this is, I found it pretty interesting, the way they've sold it in this is that he's never been a dad before, or he's never been a potential dad before, he's never even been close to that before.
Okay, I'll let it slide this time, comic books.
Yeah. And that's basically how I'm interpreting it anyway. Because the first thing he asks her is, look, is it going to be a boy or a girl?
I mean, I assume that's... Sorry, no, is it going to be Victor Jr. or Victoria?
Victor or Victoria. Anyway.
My God, I didn't even realise I made a reference to that.
We're not talking about Ed Wood movies here. Anyway, some parts good, some parts bad, but overall, I wouldn't say this was the best of the Iron Man stories.
Yeah, it's certainly no that time Tony Stark's armor became sentient and decided it loved him, sort of ripped out its own robot heart and shoved it in Tony's chest.
Yeah.
No, because that's not a good. That's not a good book.
Yeah, no, no, it's not that level of bad, thankfully. But it's, you know, I have to admit, looking back on it, great words, great art, great comic. It's got some great words. It's got some great art. It's got some great bits of comics. So technically, that's true.
What a plot twist to end on.
Yes. Over to you then, Andrew.
Yep. So I have got one last one to quickly run through. It is The Amazing Spider-Man Family Business, which is written by Mark Waid and James Robinson, with art by Gabriel Del Otto and pencils by Werther Della Adera.
Is this where Peter Parconi becomes, you know, Spider-Man, but he's also a mafia boss?
God, that is, that you are just like butchering that name more and more.
I know.
I hope by next week it's just some like Lovecraftian horrifying mismatch of vowels.
Yes.
But yeah, no, this actually is not part of any Marvel series. It is a Marvel original graphic novel.
Ooh.
Which is something I think that they stopped doing that. Because this weirdly enough, is from 2014.
I was going to say, I've not seen an original Marvel graphic novel involving a mainstream character for quite a while now.
Yeah, because I mean, I think it was like back then, they did do a few, because they did they did Avengers Endless Wartime and Avengers Rage of Ultron. Quick side note, Avengers Rage of Ultron is freaking amazing and you should definitely read it if you haven't. It's like the definitive Ultron story. But this isn't, because it's about Spider-Man. That's my in-depth review.
And it's about Spider-Man's family business, is it? Are they, what, do they have a chip shop or a delicatessen or something?
Is it? Well, no, because that is, as any, you know, long-time Spider-Man fan knows, that is definitely not what the Parker family business is. So in what was a fun twist to a lot of Spider-Man stories, that the villains aren't actually interested in Spider-Man in this one.
Oh?
No, who they're after is Peter Parker, son of legendary super spies Richard and Mary Parker.
Oh.
Yes, it's one of my favourite, like, weird comic storylines coming back.
Now there's a blast from the past.
It is, because it's one of those things that I always forget, but it's, like, super cool, is that Spider-Man's parents were, like, top S.H.I.E.L.D. agents. So anyway, the Kingpin, he wants to get his hands on Peter because years ago, Richard locked away kind of a hoard of Nazi gold, which was guarded by a giant robot called the Sleeper. So to kind of stop the Sleeper ever awakening and kind of wreaking havoc on the world, he locked it away and sealed it with an advanced like facial scanner. And so now everyone wants Peter, because he's the only person on the planet with a similar enough face to make it work. Or is he? Because, you know, while running from mysterious like mercenary types, he's rescued by a woman who introduces herself as Teresa Parker, Peter's long-lost sister. Dun, dun, dun.
I am.
Actually, no, it's not even dun, dun, dun. It's dun, 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 dun.
I just want to ask a question, right? You said there's it's a facial scanner, facial recognition, yeah?
Yeah.
And that Peter Parker is the only one with a similar enough face. Does that mean his sister also looks like his dad?
Well, maybe. That all depends on whether she's actually his sister.
Yeah, because I'm just worried now, because I've seen some of the bits where his dad apparently had a mustache.
Hey, she's a spy. Everyone knows you got to have a fake mustache if you're a spy. Yeah, no, I love it. So what I really like is kind of the first like thoughts that are going through Peter's head when he meets his sister are just, is it Chameleon? Is it Mysterio? Like, just running through a list of all the, like, shape-shifting villains it could be.
Well, it's an obvious Peter Parker thing to do.
It is, and yeah, this is just, it's a really fun book. It's like, it's this big globe-trotting adventure through, like, France and the Alps and then Egypt. And of course, there is a bit where they have to infiltrate a casino, which is great, because can you imagine more of a place where the Parker look would stick out?
Yeah, true.
Also, there's one bit which is retroactively hilarious given Spider-Verse.
Yeah.
Which is, because at the casino, they get attacked by a Cyclone, who is like a supervillain with wind powers. So obviously Peter has to change into Spider-Man and fight him off. And then he tries to like explain it to Therese as being, oh no, no, I'm not Spider-Man. I am Le Homme d'Arachne. It turns out Spider-Man are a franchise now, which is great because turns out actually they are a franchise.
Anything else you want to say about that?
No, just that it is a very fun little read. And it's great because, you know, it's a graphic novel. It's a done in one story. So, like, if someone isn't super familiar with Spider-Man, you can just, like, give them this as a nice sort of way to get into the franchise.
Awesome. Awesome, awesome, awesome. I suppose that's us done for this week then, isn't it?
I think it is.
So, anyway, let us know what you think of this new look, all new, all changed four panel.
I mean, the fact that we're, like, awkwardly stumbling our way through an outro does suggest it. Things have not changed all that much.
Yeah, they haven't changed all that much. We basically just dropped the news because the news was boring and what we talk about is much more interesting. Anyway, so if you want to catch up with any of our shows or any of the other shows on the Geek Show Podcast Network, check out our website where they're all available and you'll find them on iTunes and various other places like that as well. That's it from us until the next time on 4Panel when we will be talking about how the Fantastic Four will look in the Marvel Universe, in the MCU. Until then, I've been Rob.
And I've been Andrew.
We'll see you all later.
Thanks for listening.